So it's Oktoberfest time, people, which means that we've got Mike for only an hour before he has to run off into the arms of some dusky Fräulein proffering him lovely jugs of ale.
Life is very, very difficult here, believe me, yeah.
So with that in mind, let's crack on then, shall we, with the podcast, which is the Linux Voice Podcast. What series and episode are we on now?
Series 3, episode 16.
Wow, how the time flies. Hey, Mike. Only 59 minutes before you can go off to the Oktoberfest.
Please, let me go.
So, I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And together we are Linux Voice. This is the Linux Voice podcast. We also do a magazine, which you can find on some shelves. But let's crack on without further ado to the news. It's news time.
The news? Is everyone sitting down for the first item of news? If you're not, take a brief pause, put down any heavy objects, and make sure you're calm, because Microsoft have created a Linux distribution.
What?
Whoa.
Best be trolling, Ben.
This, as far as I can tell, isn't an April Fool's joke. It's a genuine news. It's not a public project, so you can't go and download it and use it yourself. I'm not sure if you'd want to, but you can't if you do. It's the operating system for a network switch that they're using for their Azure network. So it's all internal for their cloud hosting, whatnot. But they've decided to use Linux rather than either one of their own operating systems or any other commercially available one.
So what exactly is the temperature in hell at the moment?
I believe it's dropping fast.
Well, the Eagles have got back together, so that happened a long time ago.
Didn't Linus say that he'd won if Microsoft did something like this?
I think it was if Microsoft ported applications to Linux.
Okay. Well, we've got that, I suppose, with Android.
I was going to say, yeah, they did that a while ago.
Yeah. Oh, well.
We could all go home now.
That's it.
Let's all go over to Munich. That is... I mean, if they've chosen it for technical reasons, that's huge. I think I've skimmed over the news and just assumed they were doing it for some Azure synergy with all the people using Linux on their cloud platform.
Yeah, my first thought when I saw the news was it was like a hosted Linux rather than using Ubuntu or Debian, use their internal one. But no, it's to do all sorts of fancy software-defined networking and whatnot.
Wow.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's quite an admission then from Microsoft that, you know, they can't make an operating system up for the task. I remember when they bought Hotmail back in the day, which was pretty much running on FreeBSD, and one of the earliest things Microsoft wanted to do was to move all this vast number of Hotmail computers over to Windows, and it took them ages to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that much of a surprise, because Windows haven't done a decent embedded system for quite some time, have they?
They've said they have.
Do they still make... Is there still a Windows embedded version? I thought they'd given up on that now.
Well, there's Windows RT, which isn't that supposed to be their embedded thing? And there's that.
Well, it's...
There's Windows 10 on the Raspberry Pi.
Oh, that's a complete joke. Have you used it?
No, I haven't. I have really... It hasn't got my, you know...
It's not Windows 10. It basically turns your Raspberry Pi into an Arduino that you can only use with a Windows 10 machine.
Oh. The Raspberry Pi Foundation must be very proud.
Yes. Yeah, it's for making endpoints on the Internet of Things. It's a complete joke.
Oh, so no Minesweeper then?
No.
Not without an extra $15.
Do you remember the really rubbishy versions of Linux that were on those netbooks a few years ago?
Yeah.
See, I have a theory that Microsoft made those.
Right, let's move on to some slightly more believable news now. Yeah. if this if we'd released this podcast maybe 3 years ago, I think the first two items of news that we've got coming up would be completely unbelievable, because the first one is Microsoft released a Linux distro, and the second one is there's 1,500 games available on Steam for Linux. Wow. I would have just straight up said you were trolling if you said that could have happened a few years ago.
We should find the podcast that we did 3 years ago and see what we were saying.
Is this the year of Linux on the desktop? Yeah.
No, it's the year of Linux in Microsoft data center. Wow.
And Steam games and consoles.
Yeah, that's madness. But this is it's a huge achievement, really, to get up to 1,500 games in, I can't remember how long Steam's been available, a couple of years now. Is it 3 years?
Maybe. So. Maybe since the rumours of it started happening, yeah. And I think Steam's Valve's consoles are due out by the end of the year.
Yeah, but that's also been true for 3 years.
Yeah. That isn't the first time I've said that, but yes.
Yeah, I think they'll come out around the same time as Half-Life 3, to be honest.
Did you guys see on Reddit, there's a bot, and it posts the Half-Life 3 supposed release date, and every time anybody mentions the game, it adds another day onto it. Apparently, the release date now is about 2,970.
That might still be optimistic.
Oh, that's a find, Mike.
Oh, yeah, that should have been a find, actually.
Brilliant news for Linux, and a great way of getting Linux into the hands of other people who might not ordinarily use Linux.
Yeah, I think we are. I think we may well see a shift in PC gamers to Linux if more games come over, because it's so much more customizable and it's much more it's much more suited to modding and that sort of thing than Windows is. You don't have to hit it with a hammer until it breaks. You can just gently mold it into the shape you want it to be.
Yeah. Which I think most gamers like to do. They all have like custom rigs and custom PCs that they put together, and I don't think many are moving to Windows 10.
No,
because do you know if you get a new motherboard or change something on the motherboard, it counts as not being the same computer anymore.
That's right. You have to make a small offering and burn it at night and ask Microsoft to reactivate your installation of Windows. Wow.
So let's move swiftly on to a piece of news that we could entirely have believed 3 years ago. Google and the French regulator are arguing over regulations.
Oh, sacré bleu.
Let's do some role play.
Yeah, let's do it.
Où est le singe?
C'est, information wants to be free.
Il est en arbre. En vacances? Yeah. Oui.
Freedom.
Oui. Les Américaines.
So is this about the right to be forgotten?
Yes, this is. Google have sort of acquiesced to the right to be forgotten in Europe, but the French data regulator have said non.
No.
The right to be forgotten is tout le monde.
Tout le monde.
I have now exhausted my knowledge of French. In Stella Artois, s'il vous plaît.
I don't think the French drink Stella Artois.
Isn't it Belgian anyway? Well, English, but. Sorry, anyway, get back to the news. Yes, the French data regulator says they've got to delete the right to be forgotten results from all the services everywhere in the world. So if you petition the French data regulator to hide stuff, it should be deleted in America, etc., etc. And Google have said no. And, well, at this point, as we record, we can't really say more than that. It's sort of hit a stalemate. In the next few days, this is likely to end in some form of resolution, probably in a protracted court battle, as these things always do. So it is an interesting, it's a sort of situation that's come up a few times where a government in one country has tried to impose its authority on a global company to make it behave in a different way around the world. It's happened in America, I think, with was it the FBI trying to get emails held in Ireland by Microsoft.
Yes.
And it's happening in Canada as well, when a court, I think it was Canada versus Google, trying to get stuff deleted worldwide as well. And it does sort of, it poses an interesting question, who governs a global company?
Yeah.
Do you have a right, does a company have a right to exert control beyond its borders? If not, who does?
Especially when, well, at least for many years, Google's entire business was based on the arbitrary nature of its searching. I mean, that's something that they still stand by, and they just haven't been allowed to stand by it. At least, and I suspect they wouldn't stand by it internally anyway. But yes, outside of France's jurisdiction, I can understand why Google says no. And I mean, I'm quite surprised that the right to be forgotten has become as accepted as it has been. I remember when the story first came up. And it's like, well, people accept it now. And in fact, in British politics, it's like a given that, yeah, you can ask to have these stories removed after so many years. Even though the stories themselves remain on the internet, they're just not indexed by Google search engine.
Yeah, it's strange. And I don't know what the rights... I don't know who's in the right on this, really.
Well, isn't it going to be just a matter of time until there's a darknet version of Google?
Well, you could just use Bing. Bing isn't bound by the right to be forgotten.
Yeah, yeah.
Although you will have to scroll through 10 pages to find what you're looking for. It's kind of equivalent.
I can. I mean,
or DuckDuckGo, of course.
French politicians. I mean, I don't know why I thought of French politicians then. But they're not going to understand that it's only in a single territory that their search results are, you know, being stopped. And it's like, well, Google is a global thing. Why can't why can other people access them? Their indiscretions.
Yeah, let's move on to some happier European government news. The Italian military is using LibreOffice now on 150,000 computers. This is the second largest European deployment of the open source Office suite, the largest being the French Interior Ministry, which has 250,000 machines.
That's fantastic news. Do we know which version of LibreOffice they're using?
I have no idea.
The reason I ask is governments tend to move very slowly in these things. And I remember when Graham and I went to visit the Linux project here in Munich, we saw that they were using very old versions of KDE and LibreOffice. And that might be frustrating for some users. I hope they're at least using a late 4.x release and not 3 point something. I hope they get the latest technology.
A Collabora do a long-term support release of LibreOffice, which is ideal for this sort of thing.
Mm.
I don't know what version it's on.
And they must be, you know, paying for support. They must have a support contract with somebody like Collabora or whoever's providing the installation. So that they must...
Or they might have their own internal support.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, for such a big thing. I mean, for such a... They must know what they're doing. But the more of the examples like this is spectacular, really, because the more examples like this we have, or the more examples of LibreOffice being used in hundreds of thousands of installations, the more confidence, you know, other government agencies and other countries are going to have in it, which is just brilliant.
Yeah, and also, they'll have particular requirements. Some things will come up that's not to scratch. And when you've got 150,000 machines, you can afford to spend a bit of money to get it right in the areas you need it right.
Yeah.
Obviously, being open source, that makes it better for everyone.
Yeah.
And there may be some cases where Excel is slightly better than Calc at certain things. I mean, I've seen plenty of discussions about that. And if that's the case, fair be it. But if 99% of people are just typing very basic documents and using spreadsheets for simple calculations, then spending all that government money on huge, massive Microsoft Office suites is just a waste. This is LibreOffice does 99% of what 99% of people need to do. So... Yeah.
I remember reading a report, I forget where it was, and this is going back 7 or 8 years, about an organization that switched from Microsoft Office to OpenOffice. And they surveyed 80% of the users hadn't noticed that they'd changed Office suites. there are some differences, but if all you're doing is typing documents and putting in tables, they're equivalent.
Yeah, I guess before the ribbon interface came into Microsoft Office, you could probably have just changed the way the icons looked.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. Right, moving on. Wikipedia has launched its own mapping services or service. It's essentially just a rendering service layer over the top of OpenStreetMap. And to my eyes, it just makes it look like Google Maps.
I thought the colours they'd chosen were brilliant. Much more usable than the default by OpenStreetMaps.
Yeah, very similar to the default by Google Maps.
Yeah, and haven't they? Isn't the, yeah, but their tiling is Wikipedia's, isn't it? Which is really nice, and it's open source, obviously. So as a source of maps for people's apps or other websites, that's completely free and looks good. It's great.
Yeah, I don't know if you can use it as sort of an API. You can't just grab the maps off it, I don't think.
No, but I guess somebody could use their tiling and create a system doing the same thing, doing that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you could use their code to recreate it. I think it's quite, because obviously the thing's been built to interlink with the other MediaWiki projects. So, you know, if you've got a Wikipedia article on the A38, you can have a nice map highlighting it. I don't know what I thought of the A38 then. I've been watching Hunted too much. It definitely looks like an interesting addition to open mapping. And sort of taking it in a different angle as well, using it for a data service like Wikipedia rather than as a pure mapping service.
Well, a lot of Wikipedia maps that I've seen in the past have been flat screenshots and, you know, PNG files.
Yeah, there's some terrible maps on there.
And, I mean, they must know how many maps they've got. Isn't open mapping amazing? We don't often stop and think about it and how liberating it is, you know, like Wikipedia itself, but the fact that geographical data and all that kind of stuff is just free.
Yeah, it's amazingly detailed as well.
Yeah, sometimes it's better than Google Maps or the equivalents now, you know, especially for local, especially when you're in a big city where, you know, you've got some local people who know what they're doing and they've put, you know, local attractions on or geocaches. It's brilliant.
Yeah, the other thing, Google Maps is terrible for footpaths and cycleways, whereas OpenStreetMap, at least if you get the right rendering layer, is quite good.
Yeah.
And hopefully it'll get a lot more people interested in open mapping as well. Obviously, there's a huge contributor base to Wikipedia. And,
there's a lot of exposure for it there, isn't there? The Wikipedia link.
And there are some free software editors for the OpenStreetMap data as well. I think I reviewed one, maybe in my past life, JOSM or something, a Java-based application.
Yeah, there's quite a few editors. I think you can even edit it straight through the website. Okay, moving on to our final piece of news this fortnight. Volkswagen has been a naughty boy in hiding their vehicle emissions from regulators. They had some super secret software running on their machines that could detect when it was on an emissions test, and it would change the sort of engine configuration or calibration to produce less nitrous oxide than under normal running. This obviously is wildly illegal, and now regulators have caught up with it. They're in all sorts of trouble.
And it was a whistleblower, wasn't it? Was it somebody at the company who blew the whistle on it?
Was it? I didn't see that, actually.
I think it may have been, which also makes the case that something like this might only ever be revealed through a whistleblower, and it affects our lives and the future of the planet.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is the reason we bring this up on our podcast. Obviously, we're not a regular motoring podcast. You may be surprised to hear.
Despite the Top Gear similarities.
It's because obviously cars are just computers with an engine slapped on the bottom. And obviously the software that runs on that is all sort of proprietary and hidden away, and you have very little access to it. And the EFF have been pushing for an exemption to the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, to allow researchers access to, not necessarily to the source code, but to actually allow access to the binary code running on the machine so it can be analysed and things that can, so you can see how your car works, so you can, at least researchers can, and sort of make sure things like this don't happen, or, you know, have some idea of what's going on. And similar for security research as well, which has been quite big news recently. However, the American copyright body has rejected it. Although have been siding with the vehicle manufacturers who have argued that allowing researchers access to this would make emissions worse, apparently, because obviously it could be misused by non-researchers to change the configuration of the engines, which wouldn't necessarily comply with emissions regulations.
It's, I mean, the DM, we haven't talked about the DMCA in quite a long time, but this is, when we talked about it, it was passed in a few years ago. It was probably to do with the ramifications for people owning their own hardware and being able to do what they want with their own hardware. And I think this is the first kind of fruit of our negativity towards the DMCA, the fact that this is what's going to happen. This is what companies will do. Volkswagen aren't going to be the only car manufacturer doing this. And it stretches to, you know, heart monitors or insulin injectors. And also, I mean, mechanics for a long time protested that they need proprietary hardware to connect to the proprietary software running on these things. It doesn't allow them to do anything that they want to. And then we're being basically a fraudulent behavior, I suppose, allegedly by Volkswagen in what they're doing, and the consequences of that, in this case for the environment, but for people's safety, it's absolutely extraordinary. And I don't know what it's going to take to make people rethink how source code is treated, and the DMCA in particular, the DMCA for cars, for goodness sake.
Yeah, I think it's sort of hard to get across to people the sort of implications of it and the ramifications, because a lot of people see this, oh, it's a company behaving badly. It's sort of, it happens in a lot of ways that you don't necessarily affect you. But this, perhaps a more visible example was a couple of months ago when there's a John Deere case over the tractor manufacturer.
Yeah, that was appalling.
Yeah, where someone couldn't repair his own tractor because of restrictions on the software. And it's this concept that when you buy something, you own it. Yeah. It's yours. You can, if you want to hit it with a hammer until it breaks, that's your prerogative. If you want to go in there with a screwdriver and try and change it, then okay, you can't expect the manufacturer to fix it if you break it, but it's your prerogative to go in and make any changes you wish to it.
Yeah.
But that's no longer the case with the DMCA. Suddenly there's this legal and technical lock that can be put on it and say, okay, you can use this hardware that you've bought in the way we've told you you can use it, but outside of that,
yeah,
you're stuffed.
And it's ironic because copyright and patents are there to kind of safeguard innovation. They're there to promote it, and they're to help you invest time in it, discovering things and then being rewarded for it, and it's doing exactly the opposite.
Yeah. I mean, patents particularly, the whole point of a patent is to allow innovation. You have to tell people your innovation, and then you get a small period in which to sell it, have a monopoly on it. But suddenly it's been transformed into some system where you get ownership of a market for some minor change.
I was also reading that apparently there's a whole culture surrounding car hacking. And in nearly every, I mean, so these are like geeks really that are messing around with hardware and software and reconfiguring their cars. And I think in almost every instance, they're making their cars more efficient, more fuel efficient, more effective. And, you know, they're not making them big gas guzzlers. They're doing exactly the opposite. They want to run their cars for cheaper. And that's what things like the DMCA are prohibiting.
That's really, really cool.
Yeah.
Well done, hackers. Well done, people.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone's arguing there shouldn't be safety legislation around this. You shouldn't be allowed just to change your car into spitting out fumes and poisoning children.
No, and one's saying we should be able to run our own car on the cars. I mean, you can do this in open source. You can make sure it only runs the software from Volkswagen. It's okay.
Yeah. And that concludes our news for this fortnight.
Thanks, Ben. So it's time for Finds of the Fortnight. Been a busy couple of weeks. I did ask the IRC channel, perhaps luckily there hasn't been the same deluge of finds. There's just been a couple. Still Void makes a point that Andrew might appreciate, that he found recently that his USB microphone is now broken or buggered in Still Void's sense. And Zed Moylan Pi, must be running on his Pi, says, I suppose my find is generic. I learn more about Linux when it doesn't work out of the box than when it does. I think they're very, very wise words. and totally related to my find, which I may as well seg into, because my find is that I needed to update Screen on my Archbox for some reason, and Screen needed a newer version of NCurses. So Screen is like the multi-session terminal emulator for the command line. NCurses is a bit like a layout engine for the command line. I couldn't be bothered in updating the whole system, so I just grabbed and updated NCurses. I probably forced it, I can't remember. But anyway, I had little idea how much updating NCurses can completely mess up your system, because everything relies on the terminal that you have installed, which for me is Bash. And with only Bash installed and now no longer working because Bash was built against the previous version of NCurses that I had installed, I couldn't do anything. I couldn't, if I'd restarted my machine, I wouldn't have been able to log in. I couldn't SSH into it. I couldn't SU into it. I couldn't do anything. It was a horrible mess that I'd got myself into. I couldn't update all the tools that I use on Arch, Pac-Man, everything. They rely on a working Bash session, and I couldn't do anything to fix it. It was just, in the end, I fixed it by downloading the binary package of Dash, which is a very minimal terminal emulator, which allowed me to enter a few commands, mostly actually to disable signature checking in Pac-Man to be able to force an update on the system, so that Bash was finally built against the version of NCurses that I had installed.
Do you think Arch users are throwing tomatoes at their screens now listening to you?
Really bad form. I just forced this update on NCurses because I quickly needed to do something. It's one of those cases, it really is one of those cases where, you know, you quickly needed to do something, you're busy, and it ends up taking like 3 hours. And it's like, oh yeah,
that's my life, basically.
It's been the story of my week, actually. I run this little ARM machine for OpenELEC on the television, and it's got a flashing blue LED that really annoys me. And so I just took it out. I took the PCB out and put a bit of blue tack over it, and somehow the whole bootloader got overwritten by me just putting this blue tack. It's just awful. And the whole circuit board seems completely... I didn't realise blue tack conducted electricity, but anyway.
Blue tack doesn't. Well, it definitely doesn't. So it's quite a good insulator.
I really don't know how I did it. I really don't know how I've done it, but I'm even using the UD... What's the port on the front? It's the... I'm using USB on the go to try and debug the bootloader, but I can't get anything working on it. The CPU seems to be still working, but...
Could it have been a static?
It could have been. I'm usually quite careful, but I mean, I didn't... I mean, I'm messing around with circuit boards all the time, but so it could have been something like that.
Because you can definitely use BlueTac on circuit boards. I've done that quite a bit.
My other find also is related to Alien Isolation is definitely coming out for Linux. I think it's at the end of October, another one of the great games on Steam. I mentioned it actually a couple of weeks ago because I've been playing it on the PlayStation, and I finished the game. And while the professional games reviews, I think, in many cases have pointed out that it's perhaps overly long, a little bit tedious in the later stages. I wouldn't let that put you off if you like the Alien Ridley Scott universe of the late 70s, early 80s. It's such a good game. I really, really enjoyed it, even to the point where I'll load it up again and go back through some of the old environments because they're so brilliantly constructed. So the fact that a game like that is coming to Linux is a really good thing. It's great. They're my finds. Anyone else want to have a go?
Yes, please.
Oh, thanks, Andrew.
Oh.
So, courtesy of Kevin Collier, I have a find. He sent one to me because I seem to be lacking behind the others.
Oh.
Which is very kind of you, Kevin. Thank you.
For 6 years now, Andrew, I think.
Shame. So, this find, it's more than 6 years, isn't it?
Is it?
It must be.
Oh, you're right. It probably is. Sorry. Anyway, I've always loved your finds because they're not anything to do with Linux.
All right, then. In that case, let's kick off with a non-Linux find. Went to the accountants last week, and he says that... Because I've been fretting about our record keeping, because I've clearly I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, I just it's just in all in the downloads folder. You know, I've got no idea how I'd find it if you ever wanted to see it. But the accountant says, yeah, as long as it's on there somewhere, it doesn't matter. It's fine. So that's great. That's great news.
I just want to give you a hug. I really do. That's my gut feeling for you having to do that. Thank you, Andrew.
It was nice to get out of the house. So that's that. That's that wonderful piece of news. Anyway, Kevin Collier says, I have a fan of the fortnight just for you, as you seem to be lacking behind the others again. So that's G-Image Reader and Tesseract OCR. I have long wanted a good GUI to operate an OCR program. That's optical character recognition. Linux seems to have lacked this. Anyway, both are packaged for Ubuntu and are just what I want. G-Image Reader can deskew a page and detect regions. If you don't like the regions, you can draw on the page. Control draw for multiple regions. And the recognized text appears on the right. It just works. Cheers, Kevin.
Excellent.
Stuff that just works, that's exactly what we want. And here's another discovery. It's script, so I'm not going to read it out, but what it does is keep an eye on the file myscript.py, and whenever you save from a text editor, it will run the script. This is extremely useful if you're lazy and can't be bothered to type the same command over and over again. It doesn't work with all text editors, just ones that completely replace the file, in which case you can replace delete self with close write. You can, of course, execute any command in a while loop, and I use it to turn markdown text and editing into HTML so I can proofread it in a browser.
Ooh.
And that's from Andrew Conway.
Oh, Andrew.
So again, not one of my finds. But we'll put that script up somewhere. And also again from Andrew Conway, I'm nothing but a conduit for other people's brilliance today. So there's a piece by Paul Mason in The Guardian. He's written a book about the decline of why capitalism is all over. So I'll take that with a pinch of salt, really. But there's a sentence in there, Wikipedia, Apache or Linux are harbingers of a new non-market open source economics. And he goes on to talk about why, you know, Twitter is enormous. Twitter is absolutely enormous and it has, you know, squillions of users. But its share price has been really, really underwhelming. And that's because he's arguing that, just for something to be useful isn't enough. Twitter, although it's massively popular and has a global reach of millions of people, there's an enormous amount of potential in there for making money. But it's just good enough.
It's too hugely ambitious. What it wants to be for itself is Google. You know, all of that kind of angel funding that Twitter's got and all the many tens of millions that are going in, it's because it's marketing itself as Google. If it was happy, I mean, what is it that Telegram now sends something like 12 billion messages a day, I don't know, has 25 employees. If Twitter just had 25 employees, it would be a huge success.
But would it be such a huge success in terms of the expectations of the New York Stock Exchange?
Well, no, it wouldn't. Is that all capitalism is then?
Well, but that's the gist of this, that, you know, you've got something absolutely enormous and useful that has a potentially absolutely enormous turnover, and yet investors don't seem all that enthused by it because investors just want growth, because the god of growth has to be fed. And it has to keep growing, like the peacock's tail or the Red Queen, and we just have to keep on the treadmill. So, and in making this point, you know, he mentions Linux and Apache as just thrown in there in this piece of mainstream news commentary, which is always nice to see. Those are not my discoveries, obviously. They're somebody else's discoveries.
Yeah, what's going on?
Those are the discoveries that I've brought.
So it was the conclusion that Linux and Apache and things aren't capitalist at all. They're a new paradigm in something.
Well, the conclusion was that while talking about Twitter, Paul Mason, who you see often on Channel 4, which is broadcast in all of our homes, apart from Ben, who doesn't have a TV license.
You do now, sorry.
He does now.
Honest.
So the point is that while trying to explain a point to a mass readership, Paul Mason has reached for the example of Linux in order to explain
something else.
All right.
The assumption being that, you know, you might have heard of this Linux thing.
Right.
Here's how it, I see. Here's how it works.
I'm not sure he's got a particularly good example there. If you're going to pick something that's not growing fast and
yes.
arguably just growing for the sake of it, you may not want to pick Linux.
Well.
There's some BSD users now shouting at their headphones.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. Anyone else want to have a go? Oh, it's difficult. I'm looking at the Hangouts window and Mike's looking very relaxed, sat back with a beer and... Ben's looking at it.
Oh, yeah.
Are those real Lederhosen you've got on Mike, or are those the made in Vietnam ones from the market?
These are my bedtime Lederhosen. They're like pyjamas. I don't wear them outside. That's a whole different dress.
A Lederhosen made out of real leather, or do you get like fake leather Lederhosen?
Yeah, both. Yes, both. To both of those questions. All the tourists turn up with cheap cotton ones that they've bought at the main station here. Yeah,
splitters.
Yeah. But yeah, proper committed drunkards actually get the real leather ones.
They last longer.
So which ones are yours?
Sorry?
Which ones are yours, Mike?
I don't actually have any yet. This is
Oh, Mike, you've ruined the magic. You've lost the news.
Yeah, this is the second year in, and... I probably should get round to that at some point. I think I'll wait until after Oktoberfest, and I'm sure they'll all drop down in price.
Or you could just go around at like 3 a.m. and take somebody else's.
Just, yeah.
Oh, that's a very appetising thought. Yeah.
What are you doing at 3 a.m. to steal someone's Lederhosen? Just while they're walking along a bit drunk, whoosh, and run off.
I don't know. I'm sorry.
Anyway, shall I express my find?
Yes.
Nobody's emailed me with any this episode. Andrew seemed to get all the luck this time. But I did find Mini Free. That's minifree.org, the Ministry of Freedom. And this is a small UK company that's making... Free Software Foundation approved laptops. They're basically the Glug Glug laptops, if you guys remember those, which is a rather unfortunate name, quite bad to pronounce. So they've been sort of rebranded, remarketed under this Mini Free LibreBoot branding. And the guy who works there has sent us one to review, which we're going to cover in Linux Voice issue 21. I've just spent a few days with it. It's basically a refurbished ThinkPad X200. Which is a bit of an older model, but it's got 8 gigs of RAM and a fast SSD drive, so it's quite snappy. It's got a fantastic old ThinkPad keyboard, way better than these shallow chiclet ones. And of course, it's 100% free software right to the core, so that even the BIOS is free software, and it runs Trisquel GNU/Linux. So yeah, we'll have more about that in issue 21 when I've spent more time with the machine, but it's looking promising. It's mostly very good. And yeah, if somebody's looking to get a completely free computing stack, Richard Stallman uses one of these machines, by the way. Yeah, minifree.org. That's my find.
That leaves you, Ben.
I've spent the last fortnight moving house. So I don't have any Linux-related finds. So in lieu of a find, I'm going to come up with something that I think we should have had years ago in our package managers and would have solved Graham's problem earlier on today, and that's the ability to roll back updates. So the one package manager that does do this, I believe, is the Nix packet manager. So if you do an update and it all goes like it shouldn't do, all you have to do is one command, roll back, you know, undo last command, control Z, and you reinstate your system to as it was before.
Ubuntu Snappy does this, by the way.
And yeah, it does, actually. Mm.
And you can do it in Arch. There isn't a Control Z, I must admit. But, I mean, it caches all of the previous packages and you can roll back to them.
Can you? Yeah. I actually didn't know that.
Yeah. But yeah. It wouldn't have helped me because Pac-Man was running through the terminal.
Of course.
Yeah.
But once you got Dash up and running, could you...
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I was able to do it through Dash. But I was a terrible security liability.
Yeah. What we need is the old school style system of little switches across the front of the computer that you can enter binary words in.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, other than that, most of my discoveries or finds this fortnight have been to do with the building regulations and how to do things like that, which are... And well, the main thing is try and work out how to reach the bottom of a set of taps from a bath that's against the wall and has no easy access to, so which I think is going to involve gaffer taping like three spanners together. But, and probably a USB webcam on a stick. So yeah, that's been my fortnight, really. Not so much time for Linuxing.
Just going to say the Ministry of Freedom is... It's as if, you know, some people haven't read George Orwell's fantastic 1984 with its ministries of love, peace, truth, and the other one. It's even...
Maybe it's irony.
Even, but, well, maybe. Maybe some people are just illiterate. Who knows? But they've even contracted it in the same way that Mini Pax is the Ministry of Peace and Mini True is the Ministry of Truth. So they've embraced the newspeak completely. I think that's actually GCHQ trolling us. They're just having a laugh.
It could be.
It's true, because if it was a genuine, you know, from HP and it didn't come with HP BIOS, you'd be suspicious. But if they tell you, oh, we've replaced the BIOS,
yeah,
you don't check that it's the Libreboot, yeah, BIOS, do you? You just, right, assume it is.
Is the do you think you should run Wireshark on your network and see if anything's going on, Mike? Is the camera on?
I don't even know if it has a camera, actually.
Oh, so you don't think it has.
It definitely does, though.
It's between the keys.
And a microphone. If I shout, kill Cameron now, what happens? When will the helicopters appear? Oh, wait, I'm in Germany. So.
This is GCHQ's solution to secure boot.
Okay, and they are our finds this fortnight. Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
Awesome, and now that we're almost finished, it's time for the halfway reminder. Still to come, we may or may not have a Speak Your Brains or a Vocalise Your Neurons, but Mike is shaking his head, indicating a lack of brains.
Yeah, nobody's emailed this in the last 2 weeks, but if anybody does, mike@linuxvoice.com.
We also have Voice of the Masses. But now, here's a friendly commercial reminder. Go to shop.linuxvoice.com and buy a subscription to Linux Voice. It's what keeps food on our tables.
And food for your dog, Andrew.
Yes, food for my dog, who is awesome. Though he was out eating plants yesterday.
Oh.
That's a step up from power cables.
Which are free. Yeah, yeah. Plants go back. Yeah, he's epic. He's an absolute... He's an apex predator, basically. He's born to kill. Now then, here's Voice of the Masses for you. We asked the masses. We've all got used to the idea of newbie-friendly distros, Ubuntu, Mandrake, Mandriva, etc. Now Linux Mint. But really, does this give a distorted view of Linux to new users? Does this mollycoddle people? And so the first time they get a broken update, they just have to run around screaming and just not know what to do. We saw one Reddit user describing his experiences when switching from Windows to Linux. And after, you know, trying the usual suspects, he had the most success with Slackware because it's simple and it follows a basic set of rules and doesn't try to do too much for you. So that got us wondering, should we start to promote more advanced distros, such as, you know, Arch and Slackware, onto new users so that they can learn how Linux works, the ins and outs of it? Or should we stick with Ubuntu, Mint, et al? Would, you know, pushing Gentoo on a new user be counterproductive? Let us know your thoughts, and you have let us know our thoughts, and the thoughts are that Ubuntu... and Mint and the easier distros are by far the best, and new users should stay the hell away from Gentoo and Arch. So there we go.
I think new users should start with an easy distro, but I think they should at some point try Arch or Slackware or Gentoo, just as a learning process in a virtual machine or whatever. It's like I tend to use Zubuntu and you know, relatively newbie-friendly distros at the moment. It's nothing to do with experience. I can run Arch and everything, and I've done that. But yeah, it's worth trying as a learning experience, not necessarily as the first distro.
I'd also say this is interesting that there's probably space for a distribution that is more DIY that isn't Arch and Slackware and Gentoo. You know, I can imagine like a course, for example, in operating systems, you know, for I don't know, teenagers, where you actually build your own distro effectively, your own operating system from scratch, but it isn't as difficult as Linux from scratch. That's something that's more spontaneous and immediate, but fun, and you can see how everything fits together.
Well, in answer to the question, should we recommend advanced distros to newbies? Javier says, short answer, no. Longer answer, no, it is a really bad idea. Unless you are ready to provide hundreds of hours of free support, in that case, it's okay. Nate Olander says, no. Luis Joaquim says, no. Short answer, no. Long answer, no way. Manuel says, no, you shouldn't do that. Reese says, not generally. Andrew Conway, it depends on the user. If the user has some interest in technical stuff, then yes, otherwise probably not. Free Tom makes a more nuanced point. He says, I don't really buy this advanced versus newbie thing. If you're going to use the likes of Mint or Ubuntu, well, you need to be able to do some command line stuff, even if you just Google the command you need every time. If you can do that, I'd pretty much recommend using Debian anyway, because it's faster, more stable, and there are loads of online instructions to look up and follow parrot fashion, even if you don't know how they work. Conversely, I wouldn't even recommend things to jet like Gentoo to people who know loads about computers, because they're just more work than they need to be for very little benefit. Yeah, it depends on the person, says David Greengas, and yes, lots of people agree it depends on the user. Crashlog, it depends on the user. While I think it should be appropriate to demand a greater degree of technical literacy from the so-called average person, as it stands, most people are terrible with computers. I think for these people, a beginner-friendly distro such as Mint is more appropriate. So, when we say good with computers, we mean Windows power users, don't we, who are switching. I mean, if you've... Mm. I put Linux on the first laptop I owned. So I've never had to learn about anything to do with Windows. But I guess a lot of people will have got quite deep into the Windows registry and setting things up.
Yeah, but you ease yourself into that, don't you? And I think that's probably the point that everybody's making. Especially if you're coming from Windows, you don't want to be, you know, overwhelmed by the complexity of the operating system in the same way as you don't with Windows. You want to get up and running and be able to check your email and browse eBay just as you would as quickly as possible. And then when you're comfortable with that, then, you know, Linux provides everything that you need in terms of getting as deep as you want.
And it's
well...
Sorry, Ben, go on.
Well, that's true. I think there is a certain user for whom the whole configurability of something like Arch would be the whole reason to switch from Windows to Linux. You know, if they've used Windows in a very high level, maybe been an admin and that sort of stuff, and the advantage for them for switching would be able to get really deep in the OS in a way that you just can't with Windows. And for them, something like Arch would be ideal. But that, admittedly, that is a very small proportion of new users.
Also, it's not as if in a typical Ubuntu or Mint installation, there's no lack of complexity there. It's Debian underneath, and that's a properly server level powerful distribution. FreeTom touched on it that, you know, Mint or Ubuntu is just Debian.
Mm.
There's loads to break in Debian. There's so much to fiddle with and fix.
It's true, but you don't have to if you don't want to.
But that's good. That's choice. new users using Arch, they're being denied the choice to not fiddle with stuff.
To a certain extent, it's to do with the defaults. Mint has a huge set of defaults, and by doing the normal stuff, all you're doing is saying, do the defaults, one button, go. Whereas in something like Arch, it doesn't have the defaults. You have to go and pick up exactly what you want. And that's really, I think, the crucial difference between the two.
And imagine if you've been using Windows for years and you understand what you're getting into when you're going to install Arch. And the feeling of satisfaction you get when you get it to first boot up, and then when you first create a working environment where you can type commands in, and then you get a network connection running, you know, and then you try installing X and then a graphical environment. I mean, that in itself.
And then you look back and realize you've just wasted a year of your life.
Well, but maybe, but, you know, like earlier on, you know, you've learned an awful lot about how computers work. Sure, you may have wasted it in terms of, you know, you won't have, you know, watched so many cat videos, but you've done some other things.
You won't have renewed your tax credits or your driver's license.
Or your TV, yeah, tax.
You won't have filed your VAT return.
I think, yeah, everyone's saying that it's good to use a basic distribution. And I think they're right. The one thing I would say, though, is there's a limit on what we would call a beginner-friendly distribution. Something like Ubuntu and Mint's fine, but when you get those ones that occasionally get created specifically for beginners and they're just completely dumbed down and useless. I think, like, the one that came on the EPC, was that Zandros?
Zandros, I believe, yeah.
And
the one created by Microsoft.
Yeah. They were just ugly, ugly things that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy.
Limpus.
Limpus. Limpus Lite.
Yeah. But, sort of the basic straightforward ones, your Ubuntu's and your Mint's, I think are perfect for beginners.
So that's it, isn't it? It's pretty conclusive.
That's it. This was a silly question. Who came up with this?
We did.
Yeah, has anyone
dissented?
We did.
It's teamwork. We are one.
We wrote one word each.
Right, hopefully we'll get back to more sensible ways next fortnight. But yeah, for now, that was the voice of the masses, and the masses have spoken.
Right, so this is the end of episode 16. I've actually got one more thing. We all had an email, but it was to info@linuxvoice.com, so it landed in my inbox from a guy called Christy Isaac. He says, my name's Christy Isaac. I'm a singer-songwriter from Colchester in the UK. And he produces electroacoustic fusion music, which he's done for the last 3 years. And he does it all with Linux. He says, I have a new EP coming out on the 9th of October. And I was wondering if you'd be interested in giving it some coverage. He says he mixes, records, and writes it all in Linux. He uses Hydrogen, Ardour, Renoise. And at the launch event for his album, his drummer's going to be using Linux as a sound module. I listened to a few of his tracks and they're pretty good, and while they weren't licensed CC by SA, he's agreed to license one for us CC by SA so that we can play out the podcast with one of his tracks.
Fantastic.
Wow. Yeah.
So
change.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I thought I'd do as soon as we said goodbye. The track that we've decided, it's called The Garden. So soon, that's what we'll play out with, The Garden by Christy Isaac. And I'll put a link in the podcast notes.
That's an awesome way to end the podcast. Brilliant.
Cool. Bye, okay. Everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
I'd take you off with me if you'd say so. In the morning as you sleep, moving slow, leave it up to me, you'd know I'd never go. Tell me so, there's a garden I found where we can go. Tell me so, we'll lie on the ground, yeah, we'll take it slow. Sleeping gets too much, hot and rough. It's not unusual, I never get enough. But there's work to be done, seeds to sow, places to be, you know it feeds the soul. out in the open, we're all on show. Leaving you sleeping, so I tiptoe. Sleeping gets too much, hot and rough. It's not unusual, I never get enough. Whoa, tell me so. There's a garden I found where we can go. Whoa, tell me so. We'll lie on the ground, yeah, we'll take it slow. Whoa.